everyone. It's time for another OneLiner.com podcast. I, as always, am Craig, and again with me, Scott Morris.
Watcher.
And Drew Tavendale.
Buongiorno.
Bit early to be saying that we're keeping up with this whole new scheduling thing, because it's only been the second podcast of our new schedule. But
we've never let that stop us before.
Yes, that's more than we've achieved on some occasions. So,
I'm declaring victory and moving on.
Yes! Without further ado, let us crack on. Scott, you and Drew both saw Cassidy Mi Padre this week, the new Will Ferrell comedy. What is that all about, sir?
Will Ferrell. It's the latest daft Will Ferrell movie, which are now so numerous they might as well have their own category in Blockbuster. We're all really waiting for Anchorman 2, which was recently announced, which very much looking forward to. But in the meanwhile, we've got Cassidy Mi Padre, which is a spoof of sorts of a kind of spaghetti western, but set in Mexico, Quesadilla western perhaps, overtones of a kind of narcotics exploitation thing. You have Will Ferrell playing the youngest son of a well-to-do rancher. He's, as is quite common for a Will Ferrell character, not the sharpest knife in the drawer, Armando. He's proud of his land and his family, but he's looking out for one very special woman to share his life with. Things really start to kick off once his brother, Raul, played by Diego Luna, returns with much hoopla, and he has a fiancée in tow, played by Genesis Rodriguez. Armando immediately suspects that, despite her beauty, she may have attached to Diego for less than pure reasons, but it turns out that it's really Raul who's on the wrong path. He's trying to establish a drugs route into America. This doesn't sit well with either the local DEA agents or the resident drug kingpin, played by Gael Garcia Bernal. He's playing Onza, who also turns out to be Genesis Rodriguez's character's abusive uncle. And before long, the entire family is drawn into a dangerous web of intrigue and violence and talking spirit jaguars and the like, as you'd expect. Now, the plot of this is not exactly central to any of this sort of silly comedy stuff. It's purposely hackneyed and cliched and all that kind of stuff, but it's probably still stronger than, say, The Hangover, for whatever that's worth. But, of course, the big interest, the big gimmick in this film is that it's all in Spanish, and quite passable Spanish as well, from what I hear, from people who should know. Of course, that's a bit of a gimmick, and along with the deliberately wooden or deliberately over-enthusiastic performances at points, and it has the whole kind of cut-rate aesthetic thing going with special effects and their sort of really dreadful models and film stock looking kind of deliberately cheap looking, that kind of thing. There's always a danger when you try and pull out a conceit like this, that going for deliberately so bad it's good ideas can kind of wind up with it just being so bad that it's bad. Cassidy Mi Padre's not quite as good at being bad as, say, Black Dynamite was, but it's pretty good at being bad, which is good. I'm confused. The bottom line is there's not really an awful lot to say about it. I think that it's pretty funny. I think it is one of Ferrell's better films, certainly in recent years. The Spanish thing might be a novelty, but I like novel things. I don't like trying to wrap up reviews like this, because it always comes out in the line of, if you like Will Ferrell films, you will like this film, because it is a Will Ferrell film.
Yeah.
But I can't really think of too much else to say about it. That's basically it. It's the same, it's a usual sort of shtick, but it happens to be in Spanish. I thought it worked reasonably well. It's quite funny. It's not the funniest film I'm going to see this year or anything like that, but it's very entertaining, but it kept me amused all the way throughout. It's not long enough to be boring or anything like that. It's paced reasonably well. There's some of the bad bits are so audaciously bad that it works pretty well, and it gives it a pretty decent amount of leeway. It's got quite strong performances, because anytime you've got actors who are actually good actors who have to pretend to be bad actors, that can look kind of weird, and it's a potential pitfall, but it does kind of work quite well here. There's a pretty strong supporting cast throughout. Yeah, it keeps it going quite well. It's stupid enough to work, and it's not.
That's a great criteria to tick off.
Well, that's what all the best kind of Will Ferrell films are. That kind of stuff, other than the kind of dafter, you know, stuff like Zoolander and all that kind of things. It just works because it's got such an audacious level of daftness that it can pull it off. And it's certainly not going to be anyone's cup of tea. And if you're the kind of person who really doesn't like Will Ferrell movies and this sort of kind of genre of daft Hollywood comedies, even though this is substantially different from the usual kind of thing, it's obviously far less glossy, it has a very different feel to it. At the end of the day, it's still the same kind of humour running through it, just with deliberately shonky special effects. However, I think it works pretty well. If it's the sort of thing you like, then you will like it.
Succinct. Drew, can you come to any less enigmatic a conclusion than that? A conclusion, I might add.
Not really, no. This is, it's in the same sort of stable as Black Dynamite, as Scott mentioned, and the likes of Grindhouse. And this, Scott mentioned spaghetti westerns, but what this is more pastiche of is Mexican romantic telenovelas. I am not at all familiar with them. Like with Grindhouse, I was never familiar with Grindhouse films, but I think if you've seen enough parodies of bad production values, you're still going to get quite a lot out of it, because bad production values tend to lead to the same mistakes. So it's only 85 minutes long, and it comes dangerously close to running out of steam before that, even with that relatively short running time. But it's reasonably funny. It's absurd. I don't have much more to add to what Scott said. It's absurd, but it's funny. There's some things that are just so utterly ridiculous that in themselves in any film would be funny. People who like this sort of thing will find this the sort of thing they like.
We hope we've been of help.
Yeah. That's so, the kind of informative, incisive opinion you come to us for, delivered in spades there. Okay, Drew, while you're waxing lyrical then, why don't you tell us a bit about Rock of Ages, which I understand you have just been subject
to. Oh, lyrically, I see what you did there too. Very clever.
I didn't actually intend to, but that's just how my mind works. Deal with it.
First of all, I'd like to tell you about the story of Rock of Ages, but I can't because it doesn't have one. But it does have a whacking great load of cliches, if that's any help, and a monkey.
Ooh, that's a start. Oh, I like a monkey.
It's also more or less the end. A small town girl arrives in LA hoping to make it big in the music industry, which is a real shock, we've not heard that one before. While she's there, she meets a boy with similar aims. They work together in a club, and they're waiting for their big break. Then a rock god comes along, tries to get his creative shit together, and some songs are sung. And there's a monkey!
Ooh, a monkey, I like a monkey.
The problem with Rock of Ages is that it's one of those, as far as I'm concerned, bewilderingly popular musicals based on the music of a particular band, or, and as in this case, a particular era and style. So in contrast to like a purpose-written musical like Chicago, where the songs tell the story, the songs in this sort of thing, and here in particular, are forced into fitting with the story, such as it is, or the story is forced to fit in with a chosen song, and it just doesn't work. It's really just the lamest of links, most paper-thin of links between songs that they thought, oh, that will sound quite good if a whole lot of people do them with some choreography. And it's really not a good basis for a film at all. I just found that I didn't enjoy the film much at all. And to me, watching Rock of Ages was like playing Guitar Hero. There was far too long spent enduring mediocre and occasionally downright bad songs, but without the payoff of something like Sabotage. And I should make it clear here that while I found one or two of the songs enjoyable enough, this really, really isn't my kind of music, and those whose music it is will undoubtedly get more out of it than I did. But I can't imagine it will be a whole lot more. And for starters, in the entire film, there is only one character, Tom Cruise's Stacey Jacks, who is about the most archetypal early 80s rock star one could possibly imagine. Everyone else in it is just a face. I mean, even people with some seriously good acting chops like Paul Giamatti and Alec Baldwin. I mean, as a stage show, I could see it being more rewarding. I think if you're actually in a theatre, experiencing a cast performing the songs live in the room that you're in, and hopefully without the batshit insane choreography of, for instance, Catherine Zeta-Jones in Hit Me With Your Best Shot in the film, it could be enjoyable if this music is your cup of tea. But as a film, no, it's pointless. There's just no good reason to watch this rather than just playing the songs in your hi-fi, or playing Guitar Hero, where at least you're interacting. Though Guitar Hero, to the best of my recollection, has no monkey. This film has a monkey.
Oh, a monkey. I like a monkey.
It's a good monkey. I like a monkey. But really, the fact it's got a monkey is the most positive thing I can find to say about it. Probably speaks volumes.
So what, a 4-star film then?
Oh yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. It's got a monkey in it.
Monkey.
I think you're talking about Russell Brand.
He's possibly the hairier of the two.
I was going to say Davy Jones, but had he popped his clog before... popped his clog, he only had one. Clogs... before principal photography had finished. Sorry, I digress.
Who was that, Craig, sir? I didn't actually hear who you said.
Davy Jones.
You know, the guy on the locker.
Yeah. Carry on.
I'd finished. Yes, oh, Russell Brand finished. And the monkey are competing for most hairy person in the film. But
did you say a monkey?
A monkey.
Oh, a monkey. I like a monkey. Scott, what did you make of it?
Much the same. I mean, the first kind of critical comment I've got about this is the same as Drew. The music's not quite my cup of tea, but at least the trailer looked sort of camp enough that I thought it might be able to pull off, and there seemed to be a decent level of talent in front of it. So, okay, let's give it a bash, but it just doesn't work. I was listening to one of Kevin Smith's numerous podcasts, and I kind of agree with him. It's just poorly written and poorly focused and really poorly directed. He was mentioning things like, as we spoke about Chicago just a bit there, that kind of works because it takes a tone and a conceit and runs with it. So in that one, while the music's concurrent with the plot, it's not that everyone just starts singing along randomly to it. It's quite clear that the music in these numbers are kind of happening inside the characters' heads, and then it will go back to making sense in the world, where in this one it's just people on a bus just randomly singing along to completely unheard of, like, mashups and medleys and this kind of thing. And I'm not looking for gritty realism in anything like this, but it really makes it very difficult to take any of the characters seriously at all.
Just, I keep on coming back to that Catherine Zeta-Jones musical number in the church singing Hit Me With Your Best Shot by Pat Benatar. Everything about it is just crazy. Like, that apparently the floor in that church is electrified the way they're dancing.
I can kind of let away with some of that, because it's clear that all the supporting characters are being played for laughs. The two sort of, I guess, nominal leads, at least emotionally, are the two, you know, star-crossed lovers at the heart of it. Diego Boneta and
Julian Hough. Yeah.
The problem is that while they've got all these people chewing the scenery around them in the supporting roles, they're desperately trying to come up with some kind of coherent love story. And it's just surrounded by so much stupidity that you can't even begin to take it seriously. They're not helped by the writing. They don't do particularly bad. I don't think any of the performances are particularly bad in here. It's just so slapdashly written.
Slapdash, yeah.
Yeah, the plot's a couple of generic stories slapped together. Okay, I could even probably let it away with that, but it doesn't even follow through with those. I mean, the whole film opens with this girl saying, right, I'm going to move to LA and pursue my dreams. How does she pursue her dream? Well, she becomes a waitress and then a stripper and never once looks for a singing gig. You could at least write one scene where she's trying to make it go over anything, but she comes to LA and immediately does nothing to advance her career. It's just stupid. They're really weak roles. And isn't it telling that I find myself looking forward to Russell Brand's ridiculous pseudo-Liverpudlian camp accent, because his double act with Baldwin's the only two characters that have any kind of rough, tiny amount of chemistry together. But I suppose none of that would matter too much if the music was blowing you away, but if you're lucky, you're going to get an adequate cover of an adequate tune, and for the most part, all these kind of mashup medley type things that they're doing are just ear-twistingly shitty. So that's the problem. It's a musical with music that sucks. It has a story that sucks. There's really not much to recommend in here. It's okay, I've seen worse films and I've probably even heard worse musicals, but there's just nothing here that's of any remote interest to a casual observer. You'd have to be a really obsessive fan of late 80s hair metal to get any kind of joy out of this, and I'm not, and I did not.
No, but it does have a monkey.
It does have a monkey.
A monkey? Ooh, I like a monkey. Disappointment then. I had high hopes of Rock of Ages. I'd gone all in on that one as my summer hit. I may have to give it a miss. I'll tell you what though, this week I did see The 5-Year Engagement, in which Jason Segel and Emily Blunt play couple Tom and Violet, who met at a New Year's party and a year later decide to get engaged. So far, so. This being a product of the Judd Apatow production stable and directed by Nick Stoller, whose previous form reads Forgetting Sarah Marshall and Get Him to the Greek, you'd expect complications, inappropriate humour, left-field interjections and a decent quotient of profanity. You would largely be correct in your assumptions, though the ingredients might not necessarily be present in the proportions you'd imagine. It's probably fair to say that The 5-Year Engagement is as relaxed and non-anarchic a comedy as we've seen from Apatow as producer. Indeed, in order to use the term comedy, one must stipulate the caveat that this is as much a shallow, soul-searching romantic drama as it is any kind of laugh fest. Situated in San Francisco, The amiable local Tom is a respected shoe chef, destined for bigger things, while English import Violet is a student of psychology, who earns a place on a prestigious course in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Big-hearted Tom assures Violet that taking a time out on their wedding plans to relocate to Michigan is a must, and despite struggling to find chefing work, and I've made a word up there, I do believe, according to spell checker anyway. Despite struggling to find chefing work once he arrives, he is, at least, buoyed by Violet's progress under the tutelage of charismatic faculty head Winton, played by Rhys Ifans. Gradually, as Violet's two-year placement becomes a more permanent prospect and Tom struggles behind the counter of a local sandwich bar, cracks begin to form in the couple's relationship, and Tom becomes increasingly resentful of Violet's own success, compounded by the knowledge that had he stayed in San Francisco, he was to be promoted to the position of head chef at his boss's flourishing new restaurant. If this all sounds like an unlikely basis for slapstick japes, then you'd be forgiven for forgetting that Apatow and his staff of director and writing buddies take great pleasure in crowbarring laughs into all kinds of situations, and here they do manage that to some degree. Presumably by design, however, Stoller and Siegel's script seems determined to task itself with walking a very precarious tightrope, concentrating as much on the drama of Tom and Violet's will-they-won't-they tribulations as it does on gross sight gags and bizarre supporting characters obsessed with, among other things, distilling mead and knitting oversized sweaters. Even the romance, childbearing and finally marriage of Tom's colleague with Violet's sister is used as much to provide reason for tension and issues of self-esteem as it is to place individuals in the firing line of crossbow-wielding toddlers during babysitting duties. It's a balancing act which relies almost entirely on the assumption that Siegel and Blunt will prove affable enough appearing to convince the audience to invest emotional currency to the value of 2 hours. And the good news is that they just about do. Disclosure of my own penchant for Emily Blunt must at this point be made, for anything involving the English Rose in question is subject to some gravitational realignment of taste and appreciation on my part, but even taking into account the skewed data of my own investigations into this movie, it still stands to judgment that Tom and Violet work well together, and are both, in slightly differing ways, deserving of our affection as an audience. Perhaps a little too much time is devoted to Tom's dwelling on his marginalised lifestyle, and the movie could do with losing a good 20 minutes, possibly more, to the cutting room floor, but provided your seating is suitably comfortable, the 5-year engagement is hardly the greatest ever offender in the runtime stakes. The biggest problem is that in trying to please the broadest possible audience, the film spreads itself somewhat thin, and actually ends up risking satisfying neither the female rom-com market nor their traditionally put-upon male companions, at whom this is also firmly targeted. This lack of total commitment toward either drama, romance or comedy also makes the film's bizarre occasional sideline and random accidental acts of maiming feel somewhat misplaced. And though these more traditionally Apatow moments don't ruin the film, they do feel as though they've dropped in from a different movie altogether. All things being equal, it's hard to dislike the 5-year engagement, and even harder to pick fault with the affability of its leads and the obvious chemistry between them. One can fully understand why Siegel intended the role of Violet for Blunt as he wrote the part, and there are far worse couples in whose company one could inadvertently find themselves for 120 minutes. Unfortunately, it's hard to imagine anyone rushing to buy the DVD 3 months from now, and I fear much of the enjoyment I gained from the film was through the shared viewing experience afforded by the big screen and the cascading laughter effect thereof. The 5-year engagement is an interesting beast and a decent stab at providing something which aims to please both sexes in equal measures. It's not going to harm the careers of anyone involved, but ultimately it probably won't bother the history books either. In summation, a perfectly enjoyable way to kill an evening, but very little else. Those were my thoughts.
Does my it have a monkey?
Thoughts. It does not have a monkey. A monkey? Ooh, I like a monkey. It could have used them at 20 minutes off the runtime and an extra monkey or two. Would have been fine. It's a very difficult movie to dislike, but at the same time, it's appreciably so light on content and so predictable that simply having a central pairing of characters with whom you sort of feel some, you know, some sort of, not affection, toward affection's the wrong idea, but they're amiable enough and 2 hours in their company is an enjoyable enough experience, but I don't know.
The sort of movie that 5 years down the line you'll have forgotten you've watched when you look at like an IMDb listing again. Is that the
I'm no great fan of the Apatow stable in general, but I found myself in this bizarre situation where I wished it would have gone one way or the other. I just wish it had been a sort of more commoner garden rom-com or a far more sort of disgustingly pitched gross out Apatow comedy, because the only moments, ultimately, as enjoyable as it was, the only moments which actually garnered any kind of reaction, either comedic musically or for whatever reason, where sort of the bizarre interjections of which we've become accustomed to from that sort of stable of filmmaking. So yeah, it was kind of an odd choice on Siegel and Stoller's part when they've written the script to include these really, like, I mean, obviously I don't want to give anything away, but sort of like bizarre moments where for no good reason whatsoever, just because he's been stumbling home drunk one night, one of the main characters sort of like falls asleep in the snow beside the road, wakes up in the morning with frostbite in his toe and has to have his toe amputated, which serves no further purpose in the film other than someone gets to sort of make really crappy jibes at him about, you know, involving wordplay on the word toe. Very, very strange. You know, also strange to have toddlers shooting people in the leg with crossbow bolts, again serving very little purpose. But I almost wish the film had just gone all in and just been a sort of crazy 2-hour montage of random shit like that. But it's good. You know, I can't not recommend it if you need to kill time. It's one of those brilliant examples of counter-programming where the spillover from Spider-Man, the people who aren't going to get into Spider-Man, they're not going to be gutted that they ended up going to see this. It's just that, like you say, Scott, they're not going to remember it 5 years from now. It'll pop up on television and you'll think, did I see that? I've got a vague recollection of having seen that. And it's a little more than that. But, you know, trying something different. Jason Segel, I am increasingly becoming appreciative of him as a fairly versatile actor. And obviously he's got some writing chops. And I need say nothing about Blunt. She has my number. She won't return my calls. I think the restraining order's a joke. We both know what she wants. She just has to realise, that's all. Scott, I'm hoping and praying that in order to salvage this week, you had a complete result from David Cronenberg's new film, Cosmopolis.
Well, I always look forward to a Cronenberg film, and it's not necessarily because I'm going to like it. In fact, statistically, I probably dislike more than I like, but I do find them dislikable in very interesting ways, which makes me like them again. So the trailer for this has a barely clad Robert Pattinson starring in this supposed thriller, which would probably have warded me away for it if it didn't have this prominent flashing of the Cronenberg brand throughout it. But as it turns out, this trailer bore next to no relation to the film anyway, but I'm maybe getting ahead of myself here. Pattinson plays Eric Packer, who is the head of some, I believe, unnamed massive tech concern, which is never clearly defined, but it seems to be what would happen if Microsoft, Google, Facebook and Apple merged. We introduced to him getting into a limo that comfortably doubles as an office and a lounge, and as it turns out, an awful lot, probably the majority of the film, happens inside this limo. It's a series of short meetings and conversations with various employees, friends and lovers. It's never particularly clear what either the company or Pattinson's character's up to at any particular point, other than some vague early doors notions of currency manipulation in the Chinese markets, with an overtone of self-destruction running through it. The only thing that we're really sure is that Pattinson is undertaking a gridlocked cross-city journey to get a haircut. Apparently, with the president being in town, there's been a credible threat against him, which over the course of the film morphs into a threat against Eric Packer instead. I suppose the bird's eye view of Cosmopolis is that it's a thriller with Eric Packer, Pattinson, trying to uncover who's behind this threat and stop it. And that's more or less what the trailer implies, but the trailer is a big fat liar. If, on first viewing, you can figure out why anything that happens is happening, or what Pattinson, or any of the character motivations are, then you're a far better person than I. A more honest description of this film would be something along the lines of Eric Packer, a guy we know very little about, talks to a bunch of people that we know very little about, with conversations that are densely packed with meanings that there's nothing like enough context to understand without some serious analysis. Meanwhile, he undertakes a bunch of actions that don't really make a lot of sense, leading to a conclusion that, thinking back, wouldn't seem plausible to have been reached given how it started. If this film sounds like it may be of limited appeal, I totally understand why. This film saw by far the highest percentage of a paying audience walkout that I've ever seen. I can't blame them. If just going back to that trailer, it's pushed at the Pattinson Twilight fangirls, and this is so unlike Twilight or any conventional film that I can totally see it not being to their taste and giving up on it. It's pushed at folks expecting a visually appealing thriller with some Pattinson sexy time overtones, and for an awful lot of the film, certainly the first hour, what you get is Pattinson sat in a car wearing a suit and sunglasses talking about financial markets.
Sounds fascinating.
Tell me more. Sorry, did you see a monkey? Oh, like a monkey.
you're not getting a monkey in this.
Uh-huh.
It demands more indulgence and patience from an audience than it has any right to. Some films that are structured like this might tempt you to stay by front-loading the film with a moment of extreme drama or something. This has a guy being driven into a traffic jam. It takes longer to get to anything interesting than is remotely sensible, and even that's mainly interesting because it's inexplicable, or at least insensible. It's trying to keep you interested by throwing these dense half bricks of dialogue at you and hoping that you'll pick up enough information while you're dodging them to kind of pique your interest and drag you along with it. It's a risky strategy at the best of times, and worse after you get the vague feeling that you've been sold a dummy. I can only imagine that this will get a terrible word of mouth from at least, it must have been about 20% of the audience that walked out, and I really wouldn't be so sure that those who stayed to the bitter end either were going to give it a particularly great report. See, I'm not entirely sure I've seen Pattinson a hell of a lot of stuff outside of the Twilight franchise.
Harry Potter film, maybe.
Harry Potter, doesn't he? That's essentially it. I'm pleasantly surprised by how well he's playing this role. It's a very oddball role, and he kind of carries it off pretty well. And there's a really good supporting cast throughout it. The problem's never really with the acting performances. In terms of direction, it doesn't have Cronenberg's frequent old-school body horror. There's none of that. There's not even a hell of a lot of violence in it. There is some towards the end, but for the most part, has a kind of Cronenbergian look more than anything else. It's got some really interesting technical use of, like, I believe it's wide-angle lenses, where he's focusing quite closely for framing some of the dialogue, and it gives this wonderful off-kilter feel to a lot of the dialogue. And in terms of sort of the direction of the thing, for something that is so dialogue and heavy and action light, I can't see that anyone would do a better job with that. But the problem is that it's a sort of film that really doesn't feel like it's supposed to be a film. It might work better as a screenplay, it might work better even as a novel. It's just so densely packed with text that may or may not have meaning or relevance. But before you can even process what has just been said, it's gone on to the next wall of speech that you're trying to work your way through, and it's incredibly difficult to get a handle on what's going on. I'm not even sure I can say if I'd like or dislike the film. I don't really think I've understood enough about it to make my mind up one way or the other. I'd probably have to watch it another few times to come up with a solid answer to why I could say that I really like it or dislike it. And I think it's an interesting film, but not so interesting that I'd ever want to watch it again. It's doing this really great job of trying to turn an audience away at every moment that it can. It's certainly not for the mass markets. I can't even figure out exactly what narrow audience it could recommend it to either. I'm largely convinced that there's something quite good under there, underneath, like, layers and layers of obfuscation, but I wouldn't want to swear to that. If you do want something completely out of the ordinary, then this may be the one for you, but bear in mind that you might wind up disliking it in ways that you may or may not find interesting. It's such a difficult film. It does itself no favours anyway throughout. It's a really difficult film to even contemplate what's going on in it. I can totally understand why people just would not care about this. It's not accessible, and it's making no attempt to be accessible, and it really just feels like the sort of thing that just shouldn't really be a film. It would work better as a book. It's not an unfilmable work. It's just something that doesn't really work as a film. It's by no means the best medium for it. I can't recommend it to anyone, really. It's just so difficult to like. It's one of these films, if you feel like challenging yourself, then you can give it a bash and see if you like it or not. I suspect it will probably play better on the home formats, where you can maybe pause it and chop it into little chunks and then think about it. But it feels a lot like you're trying to watch the character development that would normally happen over a 12-episode mini-series on telly, just compressed into about, 2 hours or something.
I have to say, I'm still quite intrigued to see it, because after his recent foray into more sort of, I suppose you would say, more mainstream thriller, although nobody does a mainstream thriller quite like David Cronenberg does a mainstream thriller. Mm-hmm. Since his sort of digression into that, what for him was uncharted territory, this seems like a return to more, not the body horror stuff, but certainly the sort of weird, the weird mind state Cronenberg, if you will.
Yeah, Naked Lunch kind of.
Yeah, Naked Lunch is something I have in mind. One of my favourite Cronenberg films, and this seems as though obviously in content entirely different. In tone, it seems like it might be quite close to that, and I think that's the reason why I'm quite intrigued to see it.
Yeah, it does, especially towards the end. But, the early going is very off-putting. It does become something far more interesting towards the end, but I would have total sympathy with everyone who's just sort of switched off by that point, because it gives you very little reason to go along with it. It asks a hell of a lot of indulgence, which it doesn't really deserve to be given from anything that is actually intrinsic to it.
Yeah.
I was just sort of checking there. It is apparently adapted from a novel, which I haven't read, but it's a sort of thing that perhaps maybe better served as a novel. No, it's tough. It's a really tough watch.
From what I can gather, a lot of the issues you have with the film, people also had with the novel as well, so it may be an issue with the source and that the story can't really be saved by being in a different format.
I might read the novel because I came very close to reading it a few years back. I was intrigued by it at the time, and so obviously the fact Cronenberg liked it enough to want to adapt it seems like it might be worth checking out, but yeah, I imagine.
I say I'm reasonably convinced there is something quite interesting in there, but the problem is that it's just hidden under so much stuff that it takes a bit of an excavation effort to actually get to it, and it, I don't think it's doing all the things around it well enough to really have you spend the time that you need to do to actually get this out. I mean, I think the cinema's a dreadful place to watch this film, actually. There's just so much stuff going on in terms of the text that if you can't parse it, and you can't because it is just throwing everything at you very quickly, then you're not really going to be able to understand why anyone's doing anything. And that was my sort of main issue with it. I think if you could chop that down a bit into more manageable sub-chunks, then it might make it a more rewarding experience. But just sort of taking it as a kind of crash course in the entire novel squeezed into a couple of hours, I think it's too tough, it's too big an ask. There's probably something in there, but it requires a bit more careful extraction.
A little bit too dense and a little bit too abstract, maybe.
Yeah.
Still, certainly marks out as an interesting watch.
It does. It's by far the most unique of the ones that we've talked about so far today.
Even if it includes no monkeys.
Not a single one of them.
God damn it. When will Cronenberg work with monkeys? Well, that was an eclectic little selection, I suppose. We covered quite a few genre bases with that bunch. I guess we will be back in a fortnight talking about, amongst other things, Total Recall remake.
Speeder Dude.
Yeah, the Spider-Man reboot, the Total Recall remake. actually, I see a pattern developing here. that could be an interesting one. Thanks very much for downloading, guys. Remember, if you want to get in touch, it's podcast@theoneliner.com. You can follow us on Twitter, @theoneliner. It'd be great to hear from you. In the meantime, I have been Craig, Scott was Scott.
Goodbye.
And Drew was undeniably Drew.
Goodbye.
Fare thee well, travellers.
Who like the monkey?
Oh, I like a monkey.
Who like the monkey?
I like a monkey.
We like the monkey. We all like the monkey.